This is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC, and my guest is Christy Rupp, an artist. Christy, welcome.
Thank you.
The thing I usually start out asking people is, how did you end up in this neck of the woods?
Oh, it's a long story. I've been living upstate since the early 80s, I guess. I was in Delaware County for 25 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah. In Bovina. Well, Andy's Bovina. And then came over here. Now I'm in my seventh year.
And you've always kept a place in the city as well as a place
yeah.
up here?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I kind of figured out very early on that if I didn't keep a studio in Brooklyn, I could swing a summer situation, get most of my work done in the summer, and then be able to leave.
But now you live on 24th Street.
Yeah, I've been there for 30 years.
And now you're doing this sculpture. Have you always done sculpture?
Yes, pretty much. Yeah.
And what was your background? Did you go to art school?
I did. First I went and got a teaching degree at RISD, teaching high school art, which I did for a long time. And then, I shouldn't say I did it for a long time. I did it for a year and decided I needed to go back to school for sculpture, so I wouldn't have to do it forever. But it really sustained me for a long time before I could get a college gig. So I think I taught high school for, on and off, maybe 20 years or something.
Oh, really?
Not full time, but...
In the New York area?
Yeah.
And where did you grow up?
Buffalo, upstate.
How did you connect with the BCB art? By the way, Christy is having a show at BCB Art, which is opening in a couple of days. And how did you happen to make that connection?
Our friend Barbara Friedman, who shows there regularly, kept telling me you should say hi to Bruce. I guess Sam had worked for the Public Art Fund in New York when I did a project there. So they were very receptive to the possibility of looking at my work. They knew it from, I guess, the early 80s.
Have you shown upstate before?
Yes. Trying to think. Yeah, on and off. Nowhere that's really a commercial gallery that's been in business for very long. Lots of little pop-up things, lots of nonprofits.
And meanwhile, you were showing in the city.
Yeah, on and off. Yeah.
You miss teaching? You don't teach anymore.
I don't. I actually bailed.
Did you miss it? Or?
I miss it. I miss the kids terribly. I miss the students. Most recently, I was at Lehman College in the Bronx, and then I was at Brooklyn before that, and I really love the CUNY system. I love it dearly. It's so interesting.
Because of the students?
Yeah. And just the whole legacy of public education in New York and the idea of, affordable tuition. We had a lot of first-generation college kids, and they were very receptive and open and wonderful, wonderful energy. A lot more fun than art school, teaching kids in art school.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Oh.
And as far as your sculpture goes, that is now, a lot of it is made out of plastic credit cards. Is this a new tack?
Not especially new. I started it before the crash in 2008. I think we were all receiving a lot of solicitations in the mail. And at some point, I realized that was really crazy and interesting and started saving them, and I didn't really know why. And then as I was reading more about global warming and climate change, and particularly frogs in the beginning, is what inspired me to really think about the connection of the credit industry and disappearing species, threatened species. And mainly because we're reading that there's fewer and fewer frogs, but there's more and more credit cards. And I just thought, we're being encouraged to charge constantly and rack up this balance and, of course, the interest. And we don't really know how much we owe, ever, especially if you don't pay the full amount every month.
Right, because it just keeps compounding.
Compounding, right. And how that was like endangered species, how that compounds in reverse.
Huh.
negatively, that, you know, as the habitat diminishes, it affects everything, migration, breeding, food. So I was seeing a seesaw with those. And then the credit industry kind of dried up a little. I mean, we don't get as many as we used to, unfortunately. And I was thinking I should start applying for more, because then they'll send me more. But people are so worried about identity theft that I wasn't sure I really wanted to get on the logs of all these crazy companies that were starting up. And then the gift card industry launched full on. I'm not exactly sure when.
Right, but suddenly you see dozens of gift cards for everybody in every store.
Yeah, and it's a product, you know. It's sold as a product. And it is a product because what they're basically doing is collecting data on all of us. Like when you give somebody a gift card, you're basically giving them access to lots of information about shopping habits, yours and the person that you're giving it to. And then I started researching just the hidden costs of the credit industry or the gift card industry. Just what an amazing consumer ripoff it is. I mean, besides providing them with this product that they can sell, which is our names and our information, all these hidden charges and fees and...
And they've actually got the money until the card is used.
It's an interest-free loan that you are giving, like Target or Walmart or Home Depot, and they're betting that you'll never quite use it all, or you'll lose the card, or it'll expire. And like endangered species, you don't really know what's on your card because there's no way to really tell. I mean, you can log into some website if you really think about it. But generally, these things just live in your wallet. And I read this fact recently that a year later, a quarter of all gift cards are unredeemed. So most of it just really is like throwing it away, throwing money away. And so it's interesting to me that people give gift cards because they don't want to have the pressure of selecting a gift for someone. So it's this kind of denial in a way. Like, why not just give someone money? You know, what's the advantage, you know, to tying up your nephew's expectation that he's got $25? You might as well just give him the $25, he'll spend it. But on a lot of them, like Olive Garden or a lot of the food ones, Applebee's, you don't really know what's on it. So you go to dinner or you go to a meal and you charge it. It's not sufficient balance. And they don't just let you make up the difference, the $250 or something. They just deny the card.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Huh. So, I mean, everywhere it's different, but that's one of the tricks of the industry. That's why it's a product. And so you would probably end up putting the card back in your wallet and paying cash and not coming there again, you know, being angry. So it may not seem like a lot of money, but I think I read somewhere it was like an $8 billion throwaway a year in America.
Is that right?
I mean, it's huge. It's huge. If they get everybody for a couple of bucks, you know. So I was just thinking, I have to really notice these. It's really interesting. They're ubiquitous. And it's a sign of the times. And I love stuff that really is an indicator of the times. And the other thing I love about them is the design. I really got interested in just all the ways they make it beautiful. And particularly some companies like Starbucks that are constantly reissuing them. For every season, every event, there's graduation ones, there's Father's Days, you know, there's everything. Baby. And the design is pretty amazing. Yeah. And then for a little extra, you can buy a container, you know, buy it with the way to give it. So I just find the whole thing fascinating, that it's really an industry. It's one of those things that didn't exist, you know, 20 years ago, and now it's like this giant industry that kind of preys on people's insecurity.
And so you have all these various colors and designs to work into your work of art.
Well, I realized I had to make some choices. Like, I couldn't just use all of them all the time. So the walrus I made is silver, and the manatee is gold, because there's fewer manatees. They're really precious and valuable. One seal I'm working on is green, and another one will be blue. But then, just for this summer, I thought it would be fun to really enjoy the summer nests of gift cards and make a bunch of frogs that were green.
And now you've also used wampum. Is that connected in any way?
Well, yes, definitely. I guess I should go back to the medium, which is encaustic for some of these things. Well, everything starts with steel, so the gift cards are framed on top of steel. But the wampum came out of a whole interest in, again, precious commodities like ivory and tortoiseshell. And I was just fascinated that wampum is money that's made from a living animal. It's a quahog shell, which is a clam shell from the East Coast, the Atlantic Coast. And it had a lot of value in the early years of the explorers and the settlers because they needed a way to trade. And they wanted things like fur and food. And they had to find something that the Indians really, really valued.
Had the Indians used this as an exchange medium before?
Yeah, they've used it historically. But what's interesting about it is because it comes from the ocean or the coastal regions, it was more valuable to Indians that didn't have access to water. Like the eastern woodlands Indians valued it very highly because they had never seen purple shell, purple stone. So the more rare it became, the more it was coveted and valued. And then as the British and the Dutch were trading more and more, there actually were people that became wampum translators. And I should backtrack a little and say that wampum isn't like a coin. We think of it as coin because when you hear about the sale of Manhattan, it was $24 of beads and trinkets. And you think, oh, that was probably some wampum beads. But wampum was traditionally woven on a belt. And if you look at the historic, we're talking 1600s, maybe some exist from before that, 16, 17, 1800s. It's a story that's woven in wampum. And basically, wampum is an agreement. It's not like a cash transaction, it's an agreement. The way our money is an agreement too. Like our money is based on faith that the treasury will back it up with actual gold. But it was generated to say, I've invested all this time making this belt, I'm trading it. This means that I want to make this land deal with you. I want you to marry my daughter. I want you to stay out of my territory. I want to trade with you. You know, it was used for these very important transactions. And the funny thing about wampum to our eyes is you can't make change because it all comes out on a belt. So that tells you like how different a little bit of the mindset would have been with the trading of the British and the Dutch and the Indians. And then eventually what happened was sort of like the tulip bust in Holland. They started counterfeiting it in Europe out of glass.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The Dutch, the French, and the British learned how to make wampum in the old country and just bring tons of it with them. And at first that kind of worked because it was beautiful and they worked really hard. We all know the Dutch can do wonderful things with glass. And then it kind of crashed the market at some point because it was no longer the agreement. But one little entry into the project for me was trying to see what did $24 worth of wampum really look like today. And you can go on eBay and buy wampum shell, wampum beads. Native Americans today, contemporary peoples, still make it, mostly for decoration and ceremony.
In belts?
No, in beads. You can buy belts too. I think belts would probably be pretty pricey. But you can use it for ornament, either necklaces or make things with it, beads, buttons. You can adorn shoes with it. So it was possible for me to go on to eBay. It took a little work, but I was able to purchase $24 worth of wampum and not pay any shipping. Like, I didn't want to pay anything more than I wanted to see exactly what $24 looked like in wampum shells.
And so what did it look like?
It's a little handful of shells. But I also needed it to model it. I really couldn't, you know, I couldn't really work from a picture anymore. I really needed it to have it, to see how it, because like any natural material, when you look at it, it looks really different depending on whose picture it is. So I needed to have it in the studio.
And when did that begin?
Maybe a year and a half ago. I think this time last year I was trying really hard to figure out how to simulate it. I wanted to make it fake. It was really important to me to make fake money. You know, just like I did this whole thing with fake ivory, and I spent a lot of time making fake tortoiseshell. The fakeness of it, to me, is really important.
And the piece you have in the show at BCB is a turtle, I think.
Yes.
How large is he?
I think it's probably about 17 inches wide and maybe 20 inches tall. It goes on the wall. And there was a whole series that I started with the turtles around the BP spill in 2010 when we were hearing about what they were doing to conceal the spill with the Corexit, the dispersant. It was actually as bad or worse than the carbon oil that was coming out, partly because it dispersed it and made it sink and made it a different chemical structure. So it was much harder to clean up. Like most oil, when it spills, goes up to the much oil, you see a surface sheen,
right,
that you can clean. But the whole point of the Corexit was to hide the body, and you know it was you couldn't fly over the spill. I mean, it was prohibited. They kept all reporters out, and people did, but they did their best with they were peppering the ocean with Corexit, and it's a petroleum based chemical that basically disperses the molecules and makes it much harder to clean up, and actually when it combines with the oil, it turns into this more lethal cocktail that actually crumbles calcium based things like coral and shell, bone, plankton. But a lot of the turtles were caught, you know, as they tried to escape, they would surface. And then you remember maybe the Wrigley's turtle is a very endangered turtle, very rare turtle in the Gulf. It's a small green turtle. And they actually were burned alive because they got caught in these big sheens that the cleanup crews were just trying to burn off. So in an effort to, you know, make the sea, you know, healthier, they wiped out this whole very important link. So I started making lots and lots of turtles, I guess back in 2010. I started them, making them that were kind of oozing, this was encaustic, but I used the encaustic as a stand-in for petroleum. And the plates of their shells were kind of oozing this stuff out from between the plates. And one thing I've always been really interested in is the visibility of these spills and these crimes, these environmental crimes. And really, in order for it to make the news, there needs to be a victim, a struggling victim. So if they can find a pelican that's oily, or a dead fish, or in this case it was a turtle, then it becomes more tragic. And it masks the tragedy of what's happening to the whole ecosystem and, of course, the economic system of the people that depend on it that didn't cause it either. So one little aside that I found fascinating was during the first Gulf spill, or the first Gulf War, when we went into Kuwait. They showed footage of Saddam Hussein burning oil fields, and then we saw these cormorants struggling in what we were told was the Gulf, was the cormorant. And that's a really hardy species. It's a very aggressive species. It's all over the world. It's a migratory bird. We have them in the Hudson. And they were actually showing us footage from the Valdez spill, the Exxon Valdez.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
But it was the same species, and it was struggling. So they figured, you know, it leads, you know, it bleeds, it leads. So it took a while for people to really start commenting on that doesn't look like the Gulf. You know, you got the species right, but that's not the right location. And it turned out they were showing us footage from the Exxon Valdez of these birds. And the reason that they were chosen is they're such good victims. They really struggle, as are pelicans. Pelicans are a very, very strong bird. But the cormorant is the bird that Chinese fishermen use. They train them, they work with them their whole life. And they're on a rope and they sit on the fishing boat and they have a ring around their neck. And the fisherman sets them on the fish and the bird goes in, grabs the fish, and then the fisherman pulls it out with the rope. And because of the ring, he can remove the fish from the bird's beak, mouth. And then the bird will go back. It won't ever give up. It's a really aggressive bird. And so it was a very good metaphor for environmental devastation to make us hate, you know, Saddam Hussein. It was a stand-in, it was a victim when they couldn't show us or didn't want to show us humans. So that's when I started really thinking a lot about our perception of spill and how we're really not interested in seeing it. We just want to see the suffering. Kind of. We want to know that there's suffering. We don't really want to see too much. And that's why I got set on these turtles, because they're such silent, amazing, you know, strong creatures, prehistoric creature. But their habitat is threatened, so there's, you know, it's harder and harder for them. And that's when I started really using the turtle as a way to kind of deal with my anger, or as a metaphor for the BP spill.
And you must have always been interested in animals and species and the ecology and that sort of thing.
Yeah, pretty much, I think, from a very young age. I don't know if you know, I had done work with rats in the city. You didn't know that? In 1977, we had a garbage strike, 3-week garbage strike in a very hot spring season. And because the city was economically in a very different place than it is today, there was a garbage strike. It was they were testing the Taylor Law, which the employees had to do certain functions. And I believe it was the private carters that were refusing to pick up, but I'm not exactly certain. I think the private carters were asking to do the work of the city pickup crews. They were asking, and so they wanted more money because the city wasn't picking up. So anyway, it was just this wreck. And we all saw tons and tons of accumulation and all kinds of private efforts to hide it. And where I lived was down in Wall Street, where not that many people, it wasn't really thought of as a residential area. It was very busy during the day. And people bought lunches. People really largely purchased their lunches, and there was a lot of garbage from that. It wasn't like they were bringing their lunch. And so they would just discard their pizza crusts and their whatever they, you know, the crust of their bread or whatever. And so the rats had really figured this out, where the best food was. And they will increase, their population will increase if the food increases for them. And so they were trying everything, especially down in Wall Street, to make it go away, just make it disappear so nobody would notice. And the pressure would be on the neighborhoods. And they just wanted business as usual down there. But I lived near a vacant lot that had been vacant for a while, near Park Row. And so people just started, or businesses started throwing their garbage in huge quantities over this construction fence. And it became like a rat city because it was protected by the construction fence. And it was also excavated. So I started noticing it and thinking, like, I have to make art about this. And what I realized was that the rat was a metaphor for the city being an ecosystem with a delicate balance. So it really became this way of understanding that nature abhors a vacuum. You know, when something isn't fulfilling its work, then something else steps in. And so that was kind of my intro to this whole economic thing of how animals stand in for metaphors. Because what happened was, I don't know if you remember, in 79, it was the middle of May, there was a huge stink about a woman being attacked by rats. And that was right on my street. And what happened was, in order to hide this garbage accumulation, the owners of that lot had purchased or rented a dumpster, which they moved on the street in front of this vacant lot. So not only was there more opportunity to accumulate, but the rats then started to think that their territory included the sidewalk and the dumpster. So whereas before they were content to have their territory be behind this, the construction fence, they now were invited to join us on the sidewalk. And that's why this attack occurred. I wasn't home. I had nothing to do with it. But it did happen on the site. I had made all these rat posters, thousands of them, some running right and some running left, so that they could be installed architecturally, running around corners or jumping into boxes, you know, just as needed. I would go out at night and put them up. And so when this event happened with the woman, the police were called, the woman ran off, hysterical, but there were witnesses and they called the police. And all that was there when the police got there were my rat posters. So it was this amazing opportunity to say, yes, this is a symptom, this isn't the problem. You know, rats are just an indicator, they're not the problem. The problem is the garbage. So I started to really think about how animals play this amazing, almost spirit role in pointing to us what's important. And then also the economics of that too.
These rat posters, it was basically a rat.
Yeah. I stole it from the subway. There was a subway ad. Remember the old subway ads that they were like cards that were translucent, they were backlit. And this one was called Starve a Rat Today, and it had a life-size picture of a rat. And 9 things you could do to secure your garbage better. But it's unthinkable today that you'd ask people to ride in a subway car with like a life-size rat above their head. I mean, you wouldn't do it today. They wouldn't, that would be too weird. But in those days, it was the late 70s, you know, New York was a living ecosystem for all of us. So I thought this poster was just too beautiful and too wonderful, and I grabbed one. And the more I appreciated the art design, you know, the art direction of it, and the lifelike quality of the picture. It was a little bigger, actually, a little scarier. It had a different kind of face, but it was naturalistic. It wasn't sensationalized. It was a photo of a rat. And the more I started to stare at it, I thought, yeah, this doesn't need to be on the subway. This needs to be on the street. So I took it to a printer. And started putting them up. But they had to be low where the garbage was. They were all like about 12 inches off the ground. And that's why they lingered for a while, because in those days, you know, everybody was putting up bills all the time. Not just for their rock concerts or their shows, but for art. People were making that kind of art. It was very common to make a conceptual piece that just made people kind of think. And any bill that you put up had a, you know, like 11-hour life to it. It would just get covered over. But because these were down on the ground, they were able to stay sometimes for months. So people saw them and, you know, either hated them or thought it was interesting. But my whole thing was never to defend the rats or... You know, they were embraced as a punk symbol for a decaying city. You know, everybody was loving that at grunge at the time. But I didn't really see it that way. I saw it as a way to talk about the city as an ecological system with a delicate balance that we were upsetting. And then after that, I got so much feedback from that, from the public, actually, that I started really learning more about pigeons and mice and all kinds of urban wildlife. And then I was off onto that whole... Like, after that, it always was very easy for me to make the connection with economics and fear, and fear of nature, and what sorts of charismatic animals we embrace. And really interested in just our perception of nature. Good animals, bad animals. And I started really studying things like the Bambi syndrome. Have you ever heard of that? Which was, well, so back in the 70s, maybe we're into the early 80s now, there was a lot of research done about animals in cities, wild dogs, wild cats. And there were all kinds of people doing PhDs in our perception of wildlife. And the Bambi, it turned out somebody did a study where they were able to demonstrate that like over half of the American public had their initial perception of nature molded by Walt Disney because of his Disney films, but also the way he made all these animated films with animals, getting into there, giving them speech, and letting them interact across species. That was a big thing of his. And in that, he portrayed a lot of myths that we embraced, that such as that predators are bad, you know, coyotes are bad, wolves are bad, which then led to a lot of slaughter, you know, a lot of unbalanced planning for our wild lands. So I got really interested in just how we develop negative hints of what species. And of course, no rat has to be born a rat. And actually, rats have saved a lot more people than they've hurt, because with research, you know, they're an amazing research species because they're so predictable and they breed so rapidly. And people used to like deer a lot more. Today, they don't really. It shows you how things have really changed. But deer actually killed a lot more people every year with car accidents. And so I did this whole project with the Hartford Insurance. You know, they showed these pictures of, like, the insurance guy showing up at the road when you had an accident. But their symbol was a deer. So I thought that was really funny that they would choose that logo. And just our perception of what's good and what's bad. But actually, you know, deer have killed a lot more people than a rat. I mean, think of how deer are used to justify having guns and needing better guns, fancier guns. If we didn't have deer, we'd probably have less guns. So again, it's a really interesting bridge in our consciousness of how we justify things that we really want based on our fears. And we've helped them make our culture, make our green spaces monocultures. You know, the forests are changing because they are starving and they eat everything that they like, and the things that they're allowed to grow up are the things they don't like. So it's a cycle. And also, you know, loss of diversity means a lot less sunlight coming into the forest, which means that the trees are all growing up very, very tall. They're all reaching for the sky. In the old days, there was much more diverse. But it's a huge, huge difference today in our woodlands from 40 years ago. An interesting place to see this is in Acra, right across from GFC at Cornell Cooperative Extension, the forest. It's Uslaw Forest. It's just south of there. They have, among other things they've done, is they've fenced off a section of the forest that they're just watching, where the deer can't get. And they're going to watch it for a long time, as opposed to the forest around it, and just see how it affects the species. So you can actually go there and see the impact of deer, and you can count the difference of species inside the fence and outside the fence. It's a fascinating project, long term. So they're very committed to sustainable forestry. Fascinating place to visit.
It seems in Asia the elephants have kind of had enough. They started counterattacking lately.
Well, they're very intelligent. I mean, we think we're training them, but they're actually learning how we think. You know, we're training them to think like us. But yeah, I mean, it was proven in the tsunami how sensitive elephants are. You know, that whole herd that went upland, their owners followed them, and those people were saved.
So the elephants sensed that something was coming.
Yeah. They led a lot of people to safety. People not really knowing what was going on. But they stampeded for higher ground. Yeah, you don't want to mess with an elephant. And they're really highly sensitive. No, I'm sure they have a full range of emotion that we're just learning about. And communication skills. You know, it's like the plants. Plants talk to us too, but we don't want to listen. We don't have the mechanism to understand them, so we think that they don't talk. But they've actually been telling us, and there's all kinds of ways people have researched this to document the ways that plants have been telling us, giving us information historically. One way is the discovery of DNA. But yeah, we just, you know, we're really only interested in our own way as humans.
Obviously, you put a lot of thought into all this.
I love the research part. It's really fun. And it's a problem with the work because there's too much info. You know, most people don't really want to work too hard conceptually to digest our work. They just want to look at it. So it's a struggle of how do you use this information creatively in a way that doesn't turn people off?
Do you bother to explain any of these things?
Well, I do, yeah. When I get the opportunity to talk to a journalist, obviously it's a wonderful opportunity. When I have an exhibition or on my website. But as I say, it's a really hard balance, and I think in general people, there is such a literacy now about how our situation is really dynamic and changing. That we're so much more, we have the language today. But most people aren't really interested in knowing, you know, in ingesting a lot of the information. They just want to know the facts. You know, the basic facts. Well, there's a series in the show that I made called Rainforest Sources of Biopirated Medicinal Compounds. And I've been to the Amazon maybe 6 times, and I've been very interested in the concept of biopiracy, which people, I'm sure the GFC audience knows all about. And it's been happening for hundreds of years where, you know, the scientist gets a grant to come to the Amazon and picks up a lot of specimens, talks to some medicine men, some shamans about their natural cures, their traditional ways of healing. And then these things are taken back. Or sometimes they go specifically looking for one thing. So these species are taken back to the Western world and analyzed in the lab, and the chemical compound is then patented in Washington, more as a molecule than as a plant. And once it's been patented, it can't be commercially harvested anymore by indigenous people.
Oh, really?
And a lot of things for pain or heart attack, inflammation, diabetes, all kinds of remedies. Which is another reason that the destruction of the rainforest is so connected to our survival, is we don't really know what's there, what we're destroying. We only know what we know. We don't know all the things that we don't have the language for, or the history, or the sophistication to understand. And we certainly don't know historically why, out of hundreds and hundreds of plants that are coming from a very diverse habitat, how these people that live there were able to like pair up a couple of plants that then could stop your heartbeat long enough to operate, to open you up and take something out, or stop your blood from bleeding out during an operation. So all these medicinal compounds are based in nature, but they get synthesized and patented. And more so really, again, with the competitive need to make money on them, it's not so much to cut out traditional medicine holders of information, but they're the ones that lose, because then they can never market this stuff themselves. They don't have the financial means to gainfully exploit them. And this isn't something that they really do commercially anyway. You know, when you're sick in the forest, you summon the healer and he heals you, and he doesn't really necessarily expect a monetary payment. Which is another really interesting way to analyze all this, is that these indigenous cultures have survived floods and plagues and earthquakes and meteors and whatever. But they can't survive a cash economy. And that's happened in one or two generations. So someone my age, I'm 66, would be like a grandmother or even a great-grandmother. And I might have some information about traditional healing, but chances are that my children and their children would have felt the economic pressure to move away and either get an education or a job. They need to, because with their loss of biodiversity, indigenous people can't really support themselves in the forest anymore, in their own habitat. We've completely fenced in those commons, and people can't. There's nowhere for them to draw the diversity that they need.
When did you first go to the Amazon?
Maybe 12 years ago. I'm not sure exactly. I think I was able to go on a sweatshop tour of Peruvian factories that were making commercially produced goods in sweatshops in the big cities. And then this group I went with, we took some time to go back to the communities that some of the organizers were from and learn about their situation and the pressure on them. But the big one that's really captured my and the world's imagination is the spills, the oil spills in the Amazon, that were never cleaned up because people thought, oh, they'll just, you know, the oil pits will just fill up with leaves and nobody will know they're there. Who's going to know? But in the Amazon, where things flood all the time, you know, everything is part of the water table. So even though if there's an oil spill, even though you dig a pit and put your waste in it, it eventually just joins the water table. It gets into people's wells. And a lot of it was just used indiscriminately, the waste products, for things like they put it on roads to keep the dust down, where people were walking barefoot, where people live right near the road. And just the mass destruction of these areas.
That was also oil drilling?
Yeah. Chevron went down. Texaco, initially. Amazon Watch is a group I've gotten to know and helped them raise money for. And they've had a court case now. I think it's gone on. It's probably more than 20 years. I'm not exactly sure when it started. But Texaco was... When you drill, you have to send water down and then it comes to get the pressure right on the well. And so what comes up is called formation water. It's water that's contaminated. So that's the waste product and it needs to go somewhere. And if nobody's looking, you can just, you know, you can just put it anywhere. And nobody was looking then because... The governments of these countries, a lot of them weren't really interested in indigenous lands. They had oil blocks that they would lease. And they really didn't want to know as long as they were making some money on it. But there's this thing called the resource curse, which we're seeing really coming to a head all over the world now, where countries that have mineral resources actually become poorer. A country like Nigeria is a really good example. Because when these things are harvested, there's nowhere to put them. There's nowhere to put the capital. There's no infrastructure to invest in. The governments are corrupt, and where you would think like the government would be making money so they can build roads and bring electricity or clean water, it actually just goes into debt. It becomes debt because the money is parked internationally and then borrowed against at usurious rates. So these countries go into debt that they can never get out of because of bad deals. So that's the resource curse, is how something like oil or diamonds, now we have like titanium and all these rare earth metals, how they actually make a country not only filthy, uninhabitable, but they actually drive a country into debt. And then with all the neoliberal reforms, they're forced into austerity to pay for things that they never had the benefit of the capital for. And in the case of Texaco, then there was a short stint where the government of Ecuador took over for a little while, and then Chevron bought the rights. So now there's a whole trail of people that have been polluting. So it's impossible to sue. I mean, they're doing it and they're winning in court, but they can't collect because it's like this hall of mirrors of who actually did it. And they can always end up saying, well, your government did it. But your government did it with neoliberal loans created. And these things aren't solvable with money anyway. You know, you can't fix cancer with money. You can't fix the water table with money. You can't bring back the diversity of a river that fed people with money. So I made this series called Rainforest Sources, where I picked kind of indicator species of a fish, an insect, a fungus, a frog. There were six of them, And it kind of integrated the molecule into the living organism to kind of look past the shell of the organism. If it's a frog, looking straight into the frog at the chemical that the frog is harvesting to create. So I really want to make that connection. Visibility question. Well, they'll be in the show. So Bruce is going to show them. It'll be interesting to see. It's a new series. I haven't shown them. So it'll be interesting to see if people really are interested, are taken in by it. I think it's a fascinating connection that we can be getting all these miracle drugs from a source that we don't even know about. And the whole concept was... the topic of Avatar that's what that was about. Was it was all about the wisdom tree, where the people, you know, the Nami, the blue people, all lived under this tree that had all everything they needed. And that was the one thing that the biopirates needed to take out. They had to take that tree out, this giant, huge tree that had all the information, all the chemicals, the shelter, it created water for these people. And that had to go. And it had to go because it was their support system. You know, that's a direct threat. Undermining these cultures is the goal. Terra nullius, you know what that means? Empty earth. It was like when Columbus discovered America. Like, there was no America before he got here. You know, and we do this everywhere. It's happening all over the world. And creating all kinds of refugee and tribal conflict. Climate refugees that are scrambling for survival. That's kind of that's what I'm interested in.
Christy, thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you for taking an interest. I hope you'll come to the show.
I'll definitely come to the show.
Good.
That was Christy Rupp, whose show Sculptures opens Saturday, September 19th at BCB Art in Hudson, 116 Warren Street, and runs through the 11th of October. There's a reception on Saturday from 6 to 8 p.m. I asked Christy what kind of music she'd like to hear accompany the interview, and she said she liked, for one thing, mbira, if I'm saying it right, the sort of finger piano we've all seen. So here's some music played by Chiwaniso, or Chiwaniso, another thing I'm just not sure how to pronounce.
Chaperaseco, ah, oh, yeah, ah, yeah, oh, yeah, Chacatanga
in
coast, Chaperaseco,
ah, oh, yeah, ah, yeah,
Chapera seco.
Ah, oh yeah, ah yeah, oh yeah.
Jacatanga rinco, chapera seco.
Ah, oh yeah, ah yeah, oh yeah.
Jacatanga rinco, chapera seco.
Ah, oh yeah, ah yeah, oh yeah.
Jacatanga rinco, chapera seco.
Ah, oh yeah, ah yeah, oh yeah.
Chichapera. 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 Chapera, chapera,
where are they? Where are they? Where are you wondering? Where are they? Where are they? Where are they? Yeah, yeah, where are they? Where are they? Where are they? Where are they? Yeah, where are they? Where are they? Where are they? Where are they? Yeah, Shakatanga rinko, shichapera seiko.
Ah, oh yeah, ah yeah, oh yeah.
Shakatanga rinko, shichapera seiko.
Ah, oh yeah, ah yeah, oh yeah.
Shakatanga rinko, shichapera seiko.
Ah, oh yeah, ah yeah, oh yeah.
Shakatanga rinko, shichapera seiko. Shichapera,
shichapera, shichapera, shichapera.